If you enjoy The Spectator's podcast, why not subscribe to the magazine as well? You can get 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12, plus a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. This is a podcast-only deal, and we hope you take us up on it.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite articles from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, Owen Matthews argues that with Erdogan's latest power move, the Turkish president's position is starting to look shaky. Having swept much of the home counties of the southeast and the rural seats in the southwest, James Heal insists that the Liberal Democrats are the new party of the posh. Francis Pike says that Chinese hypersonic missiles pose a grave danger to America's aircraft carriers. Reviewing Norway's War, A People's Struggle Against Nazi Tyranny, 1940-45, by Robert Ferguson, Christian House highlights a forgotten occupation of the Second World War. And finally, Mark Mason provides his notes on coins. Up first, Owen Matthews.
Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has never been so weak nor so strong. At home, he is facing the most potent challenge to his power since an armed coup in 2016, in the form of a serious electoral challenger, whom he has just jailed, causing massive protests and unsettling the money markets. Internationally, though, he has never been stronger. Every major power bloc in the world, it seems, needs Turkey's help, with issues ranging from immigration to peacekeeping and energy supplies. For Europe, Erdogan remains a major gas supplier and an essential bulwark against immigrants from Syria and Afghanistan. Turkey is a powerful NATO member with a 350,000-strong army and a booming defence industry, which could play a leading role in rearming Europe and participating in a peacekeeping force in Ukraine. For Russia, Erdogan has played a key middleman role in Black Sea shipping negotiations with Kiev, while Turkey remains a major export route for Russian gas. It has refused to sign up to European sanctions and remains a key trading partner of Moscow's. Yet Turkey remains an ally and trading partner of Ukraine, with a company owned by Erdogan's son-in-law supplying the country's Bayraktar II drones. Most important is Erdogan's continued strong relations with the US. Turkey remains an essential, though not wholly reliable, ally in Syria and against Iran. Donald Trump is a big admirer of Erdogan, and reports suggest he could visit Washington next month. A recent conversation between the two leaders was described as great and really transformational by Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff. Ekrem İmamoğlu, Erdogan's only opponent with a real chance of winning the next presidential election, was arrested 2 days after the Trump call. It was almost as if Erdogan was testing the temperature of his relationship with Trump before making his fateful move. The gamble paid off. Washington's pushback has been minimal. Quotes, "We would encourage Turkey to respect human rights and handle its internal framework appropriately," said a State Department spokesperson as Erdogan's troops cracked heads and doused tens of thousands of protesters on the streets of Istanbul with tear gas. Quotes, "But we will not comment on domestic issues," end quote. Contrast this with the condemnation meted out by Washington and Brussels on Belarus in 2020, when Alexander Lukashenko used violence against protesters in Minsk. Quote, "This is happening because Erdogan feels both threatened and emboldened," says Soner Çağaptay, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute. Quote, "Threatened because İmamoğlu will defeat him, if free to run, and emboldened because, as far as the global community is concerned, he is free to do whatever he likes domestically," end quote. Erdogan has spent years eroding democracy, eliminating opposition media, stifling dissent, packing the judiciary, and purging Turkey's army and civil service. Removing İmamoğlu is his most blatant power move yet. Judges appointed by Erdogan's ruling AK Party had already stacked corruption charges against İmamoğlu. University authorities had even rescinded his degree, rendering him technically ineligible to run for president. But his arrest and imprisonment was Erdogan's nuclear option. It came on the eve of İmamoğlu's appointment as the official candidate of the main opposition Republican People's Party, or CHP. The resulting protests, the biggest ever against Erdogan, reflect İmamoğlu's popularity and the disconnect between Istanbul and the Anatolian heartland, Erdogan's religious conservative power base. The CHP chairman, Özgür Özel, described the arrest as a coup against the man they believe is Turkey's next president. And 15 million people, the vast majority not even CHP party members, showed up over the weekend to symbolically vote for İmamoğlu as the CHP's candidate. Instead of sinking his main rival's candidacy, Erdogan has created a martyr. He has also caused a run on the lira that wiped out 79% of the country's foreign exchange reserves from last year in just 3 days, and prompted a draconian month-long ban on short selling on the Istanbul Stock Exchange. But this is by no means Erdogan's first rodeo. He has faced serious challenges before and not shrunk from putting them down in brutal ways. In the wake of a 2016 coup attempt by the army, he imprisoned more than 100,000 people and launched the purge of the police, military and judiciary. During protests that broke out across Turkey in 2013 and snowballed into weeks-long anti-regime showdown between protesters and police, 6 people were killed and at least 7,478 injured. European and US protests over that were pretty muted too. The aftermath of the Arab Spring was underway, with Erdogan's diplomats playing firefighting roles, and Bashar al-Assad was starting his bloody crackdown in Syria. The West has always placed pragmatic international relations ahead of defending Turkish democracy. This time, though, Erdogan's authoritarian tendencies have been truly unleashed. His power has hitherto been tempered by regular elections, which, despite media stifling and local rigging, still produced results that occasionally defied his government, for instance, for mayor of Istanbul in 2019 and 2024. Now, he seems to be tilting directly at two fundamental aspects of the legacy of Atatürk, founder of the Republic of Turkey: secularism and democracy. Back in 1996, Erdogan, himself then a popular opposition mayor of Istanbul, was quoted, though he has denied it, as saying that, quotes, "democracy is like a tram, you ride it until you reach your destination," end quote. 2 years later, he was in jail for reciting a religious poem with the line, "Our minarets are our bayonets," end quote. Though he was then banned from holding office because of that conviction, his AK Party swept to power in 2002. Now it seems the democracy train has taken him as far as he needs, to a place of absolute power comparable to that of Central Asia's dictators. The current geopolitical moment dictates that Turkey's Western allies, Atatürk's one-time role models, turn a blind eye. But in truth, the death of the biggest Muslim democracy in the region should be ringing serious alarm bells across the free world.
That was Owen Matthews. Next, James Heal.
English social season has begun, kicking off with Gold Cup Day. But this year, there is a new common denominator in the seats of southern England, where the middle classes congregate, Liberal Democrat MPs. From the Cheltenham Festival in March, right the way through to Goodwood in September, it is Ed Davies' party which represents the constituencies where Britain's bourgeoisie are most comfortable. Whether it is the boast race in April, Richmond, or the Derby in June, Epsom and Yule, or even Wimbledon and Henley in July, everywhere Pims is served, a Lib Dem is the local MP. They dominate the Bowden Belt, and even Tories despair that the Lib Dems are the real party of the posh. At this week's spring conference, the party was in an optimistic mood. They were thoroughly at home in the genteel, remain-voting spa town of Harrogate, a typical Lib Dem seat save for its Yorkshire location. In England, the party only holds 6 seats north of the Midlands, but they tend to be places where the lattes come with oat milk. "The rest have gales, we have Betty's," jokes a northern Lib Dem. Of the party's 59 gains in England last July, 44 came in either the South East, 23 of them, or South West, 21 of those. A WhatsApp chat called Surrey Massive has become one of the noisier Lib Dem forums. Like dogs and their owners, most of Davies' new MPs look like the seats they now represent. The party's careful selection process meant candidates in target seats were chosen 2 years before polling day. Most were born and raised in southern England. A fifth went to Oxbridge and a third to private schools, including Ampleforth, Warminster and Cheltenham Ladies College. Once a Liberal member could be caricatured as an activist in sandals, now they are more likely to be found wearing Sloane gilets. 1 in 8 Lib Dems in Parliament boast ties with the armed services, the same ratio as the Tories, the traditional forces party. 9 of the 39 MPs with a military background in the Commons are now Lib Dems, compared with just 1 last time around. They include 4 members of the Territorial Army and 2 from the RAF. Royal Witten Bassett, GCHQ and RAF Brise Norton are all located in Lib Dem constituencies. Many of the new MPs are from Tory families. The parents of Mike Martin, the MP for Tunbridge Wells, met at a Richmond Conservative Association dance. His father stood for Margaret Thatcher's party at the 1983 election. 30 years on, the sun symbolises the right flight away from the Conservatives. There are Liberal long marches. Tessa Munt and Andrew George are retreads from the coalition era. Rachel Gilmore's first bid was in 1997. Zoe Franklin won Guildford at her third attempt. but much of the 2024 intake could be characterised as Waitrose wets, radicalised by the campaign to remain or rejoin the EU. Liz Jarvis defected from Labour, citing the perfect storm of Jeremy Corbyn and Brexit. Chris Coughlan quit the Foreign Office to co-found the obscure pro-EU Renew Party before he joined the Lib Dems. Monica Harding joined in 2019, claiming she was fed up with shouting at the TV. Like the Liberals of Jeremy Thought's era, European unity is their great cause. Their overall tally of 72 MPs makes them the largest third party in Parliament in 100 years. As voters in the so-called Blue Wall soured on the Tories, Ed Davies' forces have been well placed to benefit. Boris Johnson, as well as having done his part in sending former Tory voters the Lib Dem way, has been something of a lodestar for Davy. From his aqua stunts to his cakeist approach to policy, the Lib Dem leader learned from Johnson how to appeal to Middle England with humour and by avoiding hard choices. Indeed, Johnson's old seat in Henley went yellow last July, along with David Cameron's Whitney base and Theresa May's Maidenhead too. And indeed, so did Surrey Heath, the old stomping ground of the Spectator's editor, Michael Gove. The local election in May offered more opportunities for Sir Ed to exploit Tory southern discontent. Gloucestershire, Devon and Oxfordshire are seen as prime territory. A YouGov poll out this week suggests the Liberal Democrats are now the most popular party in the south of England, excluding London. Future gains could come from reprising the old Liberal trick of being noisy neighbours, winning over seats that border yellow constituencies. The capture of St Albans in 2019 enabled victory in Harpenden 5 years later. Jeremy Hunt, the former Chancellor, is now in an unenviable position. His Surrey seat is surrounded by a trio of Liberal Democrats sitting on majorities of more than 5,000. Challenge for these MPs, having won over Tory constituencies, is how best to deal with a Labour government. Instinctively, some confess to still feeling more comfortable attacking the Tories. "I came into politics because of them," admits one. In his speech last weekend, Sir Ed made no fewer than 15 references to the Conservatives. Labour warranted just five. Some within the party fear that going too hard on Keir Starmer could cost them the borrowed votes of Labour supporters in southern seats. A quarter of Davies' 2024 voters from the left had supported the party for tactical reasons. The inheritance tax raid on farmers means Lib Dems in the southwest have to articulate rural anger and channel their inner Clarkson. A new anti-Labour unit has been set up in Lib Dem HQ to refine attacks on Starmer's government. The two centre-left parties had little reason to quarrel in the last election. For the north of England, a series of Lib Lab straight fights now loom. In May, there is the Hull and East Yorkshire mayoralty. After that, council elections loom in Newcastle, Sheffield and Liverpool, this last led by the rising star Carl Cashman. "The fights will be micro, not macro," predicted one MP. Winter fuel is a favourite attack line, but social care and special educational needs offer long-term campaigning potential throughout this parliament too. The Tories, meanwhile, have few new ideas on how to counter the Liberal Democrats. "It's like ridding your garden of Japanese knotweed," complains one MP. A defeated colleague says there are two distinguishing features of the Lib Dem 2024 voter: long drives and sanctimony. Most begrudgingly praise the door-knocking prowess of Davies' suburban Stakhanovites, in contrast to the Tories and their paleontological canvassing data. A common complaint among Tories in the last parliament was CCHQ's inability to provide effective attacks on the Liberal Democrats. Graphics attacking Starmer on small boats were photoshopped with Ed Davies' face, but, says one Blue Wall Tory, lots of our voters didn't care. "The best bet," suggests one senior Tory aide, "is reprising the 2010 strategy of love-bombing the Liberal Democrats, siding with them on some issues to hoover up their support." Others suggest providing a concrete economic offer and framing 2029 as a referendum on Labour. The Lib Dems' big risk is they lose their Blue Wall voters and pile on disillusioned left voters in seats it's hard for them to win, says Luke Trill of polling firm More in Common. "It's a dilemma. Most of their Tories are centre-left, but the voters they need to keep are the grumpy Tories." It was Hal McMillan who once asked his own officials, "I'm always hearing about the middle classes. What is it they really want? Can you put it down on a sheet of notepaper, and then I will see whether we can give it to them? A Tory revival in the South may be possible only when a plausible offer is found." As for Sir Ed's party, they are enjoying the good times. Among MPs, there is talk of a decade of Davy. A strategy for the next election will develop in due course. "We used to talk of two-horse races," says one member of the 2024 intake. "But now we're in an age of four-way scraps." For the Lib Dems, Boris Johnson's mantra holds true. There are no disasters, only opportunities.
That was James Heal, and now Francis Pike.
2 weeks ago, a bright light streaked through the night sky above Inner Mongolia. It was not an asteroid. The US Center for Strategic and International Studies, which released the footage, reported that it was China's testing of a missile traveling at approximately 6,900 miles per hour. When China's DF-27 hypersonic missile was first revealed in 2021, the US military was shaken. General Mark Milley, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, described it as a Sputnik moment. Congress's Nuclear Weapons and Arms Control Working Group was so alarmed that it wrote to President Joe Biden, warning him that the development of hypersonic weapons could fuel an arms race that we cannot afford and should seek to avoid. Every senior US naval officer I've spoken to has expressed concern. China's hypersonic missiles come in three flavours. One, the scramjet, is propelled by an engine that mixes air and fuel at the right temperature, air pressure and density. It is manoeuvrable and can fly low, which makes it difficult to intercept. The People's Liberation Army Air Force has developed an air-to-air missile for fighter aircraft that has a range of more than 600 miles. Glide versions, such as the DF-27, consist of two parts. A ballistic missile combined with a bomb that detaches and glides towards its target at hypersonic speed, which is anything faster than Mach 5 or around 3,800 mph. It can also shift direction, which makes detection and neutralization extremely difficult. Like China, Russia has a suite of hypersonic weapons. The deadliest is the Avangard Glide missile, which has had four test launches. The Mach 10 Oreshnik, described by President Vladimir Putin as unstoppable, is now scheduled for volume production. The problem for the US is that hypersonic missiles pose a grave danger to America's most important weapon system, its aircraft carriers. The US has ruled the post-war waves by dint of its ability to project global air power. It was Yorktown-class aircraft carriers that destroyed the Japanese Navy at the Battle of Midway in 1942, replacing battleships as the world's most feared capital ships. Ever since, carriers have reigned supreme. Today, the US Navy's carrier force largely comprises the Nimitz class, named after Chester Nimitz of Pacific War fame. They were designed in 1968 and introduced into service in 1975. The 10th and last of the class, the USS George H.W. Bush, was commissioned in 2009. Today it sits in Norfolk, Virginia, where it's being fitted out for its next deployment. Last week I was sitting in the captain's chair on its bridge, looking over a flight deck more than three times longer than a football pitch, and capable of carrying up to 90 aircraft. It is an awesome edifice, in effect a floating city that, when on deployment, houses and feeds 6,000 people, 3,500 sailors and 2,500 in its air arm. It is powered by two atomic reactors. The US fleet carriers are the embodiment of America's global reach. On any deployment, their entourage comprises at least two destroyers, a cruiser, and a frigate, as well as submarines. Yet in the event of any major power conflict, the speed, maneuverability, and range of Russia and China's new hypersonic missiles are challenges for which America seemingly has no answers. A conventional missile has a 60% chance of being shot down by a US shipboard standard missile, and the hypersonic missile might give time for only one shot. As a US naval officer told me, we might be able to deal with a single hypersonic missile, but 10? Does this mean that the days of the aircraft carrier are over? At present, sitting next to the USS George H.W. Bush in Norfolk is the USS Gerald R. Ford, the first of the next generation of carriers. 10 Ford-class carriers are planned at a cost of $13 billion each. The People's Liberation Navy also believe in the future of aircraft carriers. China currently operates two. Liaoning is ex-Soviet, but the country launched its own built carrier, Shandong, in 2019. A third, Fujian, is undergoing sea trials. According to the former Chinese naval officer Wang Yunfei, a fourth, rumoured to be nuclear-powered and built to match the USS Ford class, has started construction. By 2035, China is expected to have six carriers, which will add to a naval fleet that's already bigger than America's. According to security analyst Brandon J. Weishaupt, China will use its carriers as an adjunct to its hypersonic land-based missiles and submarines as part of a multi-step strategy for dominating the Indo-Pacific, starting with the first island chain, which runs from Japan through Taiwan all the way down to the Philippines. Britain has two relatively small carriers, HMS Queen Elizabeth and HMS Prince of Wales. Being non-nuclear, they are suitable for deployment in the Mediterranean and perhaps the Middle East, but Asia is a stretch. The most likely scenario for their combat use, along with the French carrier Charles de Gaulle, would be if Russia invaded the Baltic states. But they would be at terminal risk from Russia's hypersonic weapons. Does Britain have a response? Rishi Sunak's government launched a billion-dollar program to produce a hypersonic missile, but only by 2030. France, somewhat ahead, started a hypersonic program in 2019, but its projects are still in the development and testing phase. By most accounts, China is way ahead in the hypersonic game, with Russia second. Although America has its own program, the long-range weapon Dark Eagle, this is reportedly only half the speed of China's newest missiles. Nevertheless, the government has ordered 300 of them at $41 million each. In the tussle between hypersonic missiles and aircraft carriers, the advantage for the time being appears to lie with the former. Will the US be able to catch up with Russia and China? It's certainly trying, but for the foreseeable future, its carrier battle groups appear vulnerable. It is going to have to develop new technologies to defend them.
That was Francis Pike. And next, Christian House.
Reading Robert Ferguson's fascinating history of the experiences of the Norwegians during the 5 years of German occupation between 1940 and 45, a collage of resistance, collaboration, and the grey areas in between, I was reminded of the remarks of two Norwegian nonagenarians. In 2011, I interviewed Gunnar Sonstaby, a hero of Norway's resistance movement, for The Spectator. The country's most decorated man, Sonstaby told me that he was spurred to acts of sabotage and the liquidation of collaborators by sheer outrage at the German presence. Conversely, earlier this year I wrote the obituary of Olav Thon, the owner of a chain of supermarkets and hotels and one of the richest men in Norway. Thon had been criticised for trading in furs with the occupying forces. He countered that he simply sold to anyone who came through the shop door. Ferguson recognises the validity of both positions, and Norway's war is full of empathy for a broad range of personal reactions to the German occupation. This began with an overnight takeover of the main cities in 1940 and ended in an ignominious surrender on 8th of May 1945. At the darkest end of this spectrum were the Norwegian Nazis, the National Unity Party, led by the infamous Vidkun Quisling. Ferguson explains that Quisling became a synonym for traitor almost immediately. Within weeks of the invasion, the term had been used in the Times. The assault on Oslo proved to be Germany's worst moment in its Norwegian campaign. In the early hours of 8th of April 1940, its heavy cruiser Blücher slid silently up the Oslo fjord and was swiftly sunk by the cannons at Oscarsborg Fortress. An estimated 1,000 German soldiers and sailors drowned. The pushback gave King Haakon VII and members of the Norwegian government enough time to flee to London, but it also allowed Quisling to occupy the void and attempt his Nazification of the country. He failed spectacularly. As Ferguson notes, a conscience struggle united the schools, the universities, the church, pupils, parents, priests, and teachers in a campaign of dogged and ultimately triumphant resistance. Ferguson is British but has made Norway his home since 1983. He is the author of Scandinavians in Search of the Soul of the North, a modern classic in which he illustrates national traits, Norwegian, Swedish, Danish, through the actions of remarkable individuals. He does something similar here.
The reference to a people struggle in the subtitle is significant. Norwegian resistance encompassed many spheres: military, propaganda, education, religion, law, and Ferguson finds engaging individuals through which to tell these sometimes subtle, sometimes thrilling insurrections. The spirited cast includes Johannes Andersen, codename Yellow Cheese. The spirited cast includes Johannes Andersen, codename Yellow Cheese, a career criminal who was the first gunman to assassinate an informer, and Ingrid Bjerkas, a devout Lutheran who sent theologically focused hate mail to Quisling and would later become Norway's first female priest. Particular focus, however, is given to Gunnar Vala, a prosecutor who led a precarious existence as a double agent, passing on intelligence to London while embedded as a seemingly enthusiastic member of Quisling's political police. He is a character worthy of Le Carré. The armed opposition of Sonstaby and his cohorts in the Oslo Gang, a group of Norwegian saboteurs trained by the British SOE, is skimmed over, having already been chronicled in numerous books and films. Number 24, a biopic of Sonstaby, has recently been released on Netflix. Ferguson is more interested in the experience of civilians stuck in the fray. Farmers in the north who had their properties razed, and officials required to pledge allegiances to the occupiers or lose their jobs. The end of the war brought a reckoning that was in line with the Norwegian psyche. The rule of law was to prevail, unlike in France, where collaborators were routinely shot, and collective guilt was placed on all Norwegians who had joined the National Unity Party. Even this relatively moderate approach was thought by some to be harsh. It became known as the Isfront, Ice Front, that took its creed from Ivan Burgrav, the Bishop of Oslo. First justice, then kindness. 30 Norwegians, including Quisling, were sentenced to death for acts of treason, murder, or torture. Ferguson is a profoundly compassionate author. Nuance and consideration are given to all parties, even the most indefensible. Quisling is portrayed as a pathetic, mentally ill figure, rather than as a cartoon villain. And he unearthed humanizing and humorous details to counter the humiliations, deprivations, and atrocities. For instance, he describes with considerable narrative flair how, in the days following the Nazi capitulation, three of Quisling's henchmen holed up in a country villa with a cache of arms and explosives. It's told like a dark farce. The Norwegian officer attempting to lure them out was hampered by a Danish journalist, furious at being denied access to the villa to interview the Nazis. The officer was amused by the situation. The journalist's display of outraged entitlement and importance helped him realize that after 5 long years, things really were getting back to normal.
That was Christian Howes, and finally, Mark Mason.
Lewis Carroll used to travel with purses divided into separate compartments, each containing the exact number of coins he'd need for a particular transaction: train fare, porter, newspaper, and so on. These days, we have one bank card which gets tapped everywhere. The coinless society might be more convenient, but it's also more boring. Coins are beautiful and fascinating. For centuries, they were the only way most people knew what their monarch looked like. Henry VIII was nicknamed Coppernose because of the way the silver coating on copper coins rubbed away, starting with his nose. Even Oliver Cromwell put himself on the currency, as a Roman emperor wearing a laurel wreath. Since Charles II, monarchs have alternated the way they face. Only the Edward VIII's vanity threatened the pattern. He should have faced right, but said his left side was better. Thankfully, his coins were never issued. Each year's Maundy money has the value in pence of the monarch's age, and contains specially minted 3p and 4p coins, which are legal tender. Britannia, currently on the £2 coin, was first employed by the Romans, depicted as a captive bowing down before their empire. But she eventually came to symbolise the country's greatness. Queen Anne even issued coins with herself in the role. Gordon Brown removed Britannia, but David Cameron reinstated her, saying she should, quote, never have been taken off in the first place. Also still in place are the letters DG for Dei Gratia, by the grace of God. In 1849, a new florin emitted them, and when a cholera epidemic broke out soon afterwards, people blamed the godless florin. The language of coins is wonderful. Farthing came from forthing, because it was a quarter of a penny, while the guinea was made of gold imported from said part of Africa. Horses were sold in guineas, worth a pound and a shilling, because the shilling was the auctioneer's commission. The 15th century angel showed the archangel Michael slaying a dragon, while Henry VII's dandiprat, worth 3 halfpence, became slang for an insignificant person. Coins haven't changed much physically. A metal disc is a metal disc. But there have been subtle tweaks. Milled edges were introduced to stop people shaving valuable metal off them. The so-called straight edges of the 50p are actually slightly curved so that they'll roll through vending machines. Pre-1992 pennies, made of copper, are now worth more than a penny because of the metal's rise in price. I'd love a reintroduction of the 11th century coin that was shaped like a clover, allowing users to break off the four leaves and use them as separate pieces of currency. The Royal Mint will be in action for a while yet. These days it's in Llantrisant, a part of South Wales unlovely enough to be known as the hole with the mint. But eventually coins are going to disappear. And what will we toss then when we need to settle a 50-50 decision? Thankfully, Brian May of Queen's still has enough sixpences to use as plectrums. When he ran out of real ones, he had some made bearing his own image rather than Queen Elizabeth's. The most unusual use for a coin has to be David Suchet's. He achieved Hercule Poirot's mincing walk by clasping a £1 coin between his buttocks.
And that's everything for this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed the podcast, we'd really appreciate a rate or a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.